And good evening, good morning, good afternoon, whatever time it is where you are. This is Tom Harris. Welcome to Tom Harris USA, episode number 92, brought to you from beautiful Chicago, Illinois, where it is extremely hot and extremely sticky today, most uncomfortable, and not enjoying this weather at all. Before I get started with what I'm going to talk about today, I just want to give a shout out here to a young Mikey Holt, who is one of my fellow presenters over on United Kingdom Radio, who run a trail for me on his show this week that I kind of did kind of at the spur of the moment at Mikey's request so that he could broadcast it on his show. So thank you, Mikey, for that little bit of plug. And if you're here because you heard that on Mikey's show, well, welcome. And hopefully you'll find this show interesting, though you'll find that it's certainly very, very, very different from anything that you're going to hear on Mikey's show. And I'm in quite the Shakespearean mood over the last couple of days, mainly because I've been watching Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet. Now, as many of you know, I do have a degree in acting from Ohio University, and I don't do a lot of acting right now, and the main reason why I'm not doing much acting right now is because I'm doing things like podcasting and internet radio, which are, I guess, sort of like acting, but not really. But I've been watching his version of Hamlet, and this isn't really going to be a movie review because, I mean, it's Shakespeare, for gosh sakes. And the fact that it's Kenneth Branagh who's doing these various Shakespearean movies, I think overall these Branagh films are quite, quite good. And I think this Hamlet is no exception. It's stylized, yet it's realistic at the same time. They set it in a setting that's not, you know, people aren't wearing tights and doublets. They've got kind of a 19th century Danish vibe going on here. And I have to say, you know, I really enjoyed other efforts by Kenneth Branagh, things like Much Ado About Nothing. And, of course, the magnificent Henry V. If you haven't seen Henry V, I would definitely run out and grab that. And that would be the Branagh version and not the Laurence Olivier version, which is good in its own right. Because I think that Branagh is, in a lot of ways, the Laurence Olivier of this generation. And I've been watching this Hamlet. It's 4 hours long. It's on two DVDs, which is pretty long for a film. And I know that there's a lot of people out there who just don't have the attention span to sit and watch a film like this. Because it is tough going occasionally, especially if you're not somebody who likes Shakespeare. If you don't appreciate the language. Now, I spent 4 years studying Shakespeare's language and really do appreciate this. And of course, the movie is very, very, very well done, very, very clear as to exactly what is going on. And there is, of course, the stereotype that Shakespeare is hard to follow, that it's hard to understand. But performed properly, Shakespeare is simple to understand because he's a very, very clear author. The problem, of course, is that how we're taught Shakespeare in public school is absolutely horrifying. If they teach it at all, which many schools don't, then it's dumbed down to the point of being ridiculous. And they don't teach you anything about scansion or teach you about pentameter, which is vital if you're going to understand Shakespeare. And the thing about Shakespeare, I mean, even though a lot of it is poetry, it actually matches very well the speech patterns that, you know, the Elizabethans actually used. So we don't think of it as being a very realistic way of speaking. But to an Elizabethan, it would have been considered a very stylized way of speaking, but they would not have had any trouble understanding it. Our language has simply evolved in a way that we don't use this sort of heightened language now. And Shakespeare performed properly, as in these Branagh movies, is absolutely understandable. If you can't follow this movie, then you can't follow any movie. It's pretty, very clear as to exactly what's happening, even if the language may seem a bit unfamiliar. But I am enjoying this, and eventually I'll pick this up. And I've watched the first two acts of it, and I've, you know, time to get a show out. So all of these sort of entertainment options kind of get shoved aside when it comes time to work on one of the shows. But at any rate, the movie is pretty long, which is kind of odd when you really consider that if you watch Hamlet on stage, it's not 4 hours long. And the reason, of course, why it would be 4 hours long in a film is because you have a lot more you can play with in a film. You have a lot of things that you can do with the setting. You have a lot of things that you can do with the spectacle of the thing, making it all look magnificent, and you can spend some time looking at the scenery and so forth. And I think that obviously there's a big advantage to doing a Shakespearean play as a film, and Bernard does, or Branagh, I never know how to pronounce that, and I know I've pronounced it both in the show, and that's very, very sloppy of me. But Branagh's love for this material is absolutely evident in all of these productions that he's done, and he had quite a string of them, actually, back in the 90s. And I think that probably about the last one, which was a complete failure, unfortunately, was his version of Love's Labour's Lost. And at the time, I certainly didn't understand why he chose that play of all the plays that he could have done. But I know he wanted to do a comedy as opposed to another tragedy, because he'd done several, you know, of these major productions and wanted to do that. And decided to do Love's Labour's Lost in the style of a 1940s musical romantic comedy. And it was a kind of a bold choice to make. Unfortunately, it was a bold failure. And so we really haven't seen much of these films since then. And that's unfortunate because, you know, I do like these films. And I think that any effort to bring Shakespeare back into the public eye, into the eye of the masses, most of whom have kind of heard about Shakespeare in school, but really don't have any idea of exactly how important this man was to English literature and therefore to our own literature. But I think this education is generally speaking a good thing. And there have been various successful efforts to do this and some that have been not so successful. And you even get something like Shakespeare in Love, which I think is of dubious value artistically, but it still kind of raises up the public profile of this William Shakespeare character. And I thought that the use of the various Shakespearean cliches was kind of clever myself. Not a great movie, but not a horrible one either. I'm not going to get into the whole Shakespeare conspiracy theories, the whole William Shakespeare didn't write his own work or did write his own work and all that. I may have talked about that in a previous episode, actually, but, you know, as somebody who studied Shakespeare, I think that his voice is very, very distinctive. And I don't think that the Victorian conceit that a working class person could not possibly have written Shakespeare's plays holds any water whatsoever. I am definitely of the opinion that William Shakespeare wrote William Shakespeare. And I completely reject the whole idea that the Victorians, and actually this kind of started with the rediscovery of Shakespeare back in the later part of the 1700s, this whole idea that nothing valuable in English literature could possibly have come from anybody but the aristocracy. And I am also not one of these people who says that you have to set Shakespeare's plays in the time that they were written. I think that's really kind of a ridiculous rule. I know that there's some hardcore Shakespearean scholars who don't like it when a director will take a Shakespeare play and update it to a modern time or try to transpose the setting of it in an effort to make it more accessible. I don't always agree that that's a bad thing, because the more identification that people can have with the characters, the better. However, you can go too far with it, and I think that Love's Labour's Lost was a good example of that. I don't think that it's one of Shakespeare's better plays. And Shakespeare definitely has, you know, his ups and downs as far as which of his plays are masterpieces and which of them are kind of forgettable. And that play, to me in particular, is a very early Shakespeare work, and I don't really think it is as significant as certainly as something like Twelfth Night, which is one of my favorite Shakespearean plays. But I have to say, you know, that Branagh in this film is absolutely wonderful. Derek Jacobi, who is playing the part of Claudius, is excellent. And this film actually contains one particular surprise for me. And this is the casting of Charlton Heston in the part of the leader of the players. If you know anything about the plot of Shakespeare, there's sort of this play within a play. And they cast Charlton Heston in the role of the head of the players. And he is fantastic. in that role. And I'm not a huge fan of Charlton Heston as an actor, but he clearly had a very strong grasp on Shakespeare because he made this crystal clear interpretation of this role. And some of the cameos in there are kind of cute. You have Robin Williams and Billy Crystal in there playing these sort of, you know, comedic cameos. The other standout in the cast in this, other than Branagh himself, who I think is absolutely wonderful, is Brian Blessed playing the ghost of Shakespeare's father. That is a tough character to make work, and he does a really nice job of it. I don't think they could have cast a more perfect individual for this part. So, hey, you know, anyway, go check it out. It is, unfortunately, 4 hours long, but I think it's worth it. Definitely worth it if you can break it up and, you know, you can break it up at the end of Act Two and then come back to it as I have done. And that's the natural break in the DVD. So anyway, so much for that. I'm going to move on now and talk a little bit about the topic that I was going to have on Plain Dudes Radio. Now, it's my own fault. I have nobody to blame for this but myself. As you all know, I'm part of this project called Plain Dudes Radio, and Plain Dudes Radio is a podcast that sort of incorporates diverse viewpoints on a particular topic and kind of combines them all into one podcast, and you can hear a myriad of voices talking about particular subjects. And I had intended this past weekend to sit down and record my bits for Plain Dudes Radio, and unfortunately, I was too late. I, you know, had made some notes, and I was sitting down to record, and I was just chatting with our good friend Suko. Suko, who does, you know, Suko and Friends over in United Kingdom Radio on Sunday afternoon. It's 5 p.m. UK time, which is 12 p.m. in New York. So it's actually 11 a.m. here in Chicago. And I went to point her to the Plain Dude site because she wanted to see it and noticed that the episode had already been posted. So this is really a case of you snooze, you lose. But I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to talk about one of the topics that I was going to talk about on that show on this program, at least have some continuity there so that my notes and my material don't go to waste. But before I do that, I have a little bit of an antidote here. As you folks remember, I was talking in the last episode about my very first hate mail. I had a piece of fan mail, which is specifically designed as a antidote to that piece of hate mail, and here is that. The title of this email is called Not Hate Mail. As a fan of your show, I am sending this message to the fan mailbox to offset your recent dissenter's drivel. Cheers, I enjoy your show thoroughly. Signed, Benjamin. Now, that would be Benjamin Miller, who I showed around Chicago a few weekends ago. Thank you, Benjamin. Now, Benjamin, you'll have to tell me when you get your microphone, because I would love to have you on the show. I know we talked about that a couple of weeks ago, and I do hope that we can have you on the show, and we can talk about the work you're doing with algae, and also about things like water fluoridation, which we had an interesting discussion about while we were walking through Grant Park. All right, so just another quick shout-out here to Atticus Stount, who I talked to a little bit after Mikey's show on Sunday and who has checked out a couple of the episodes of the show. Hope you stick around, and hopefully you can participate in the show as well. All right, so moving on now. So in this Plain Dudes Radio episode that I was just talking about, one of the topics that they're covering in this show is animal morality, and the question of whether animals have morals or not. And I think it's just astounding to me that anyone was actually even talking about the subject. And the reason why I say this is because, say, 20 years ago, nobody would be talking about even the possibility of animals having morality. And I think that there's two reasons for this. And you can kind of summarize it into two different categories. One is that we just don't know that much about the way animals and their social groupings and so forth work. It's a lack of knowledge of the animal kingdom. And the other side of this is that we tend to hold a very exalted role for humanity. And sort of the Western paradigm is that, particularly this is of you know, Christian, Judeo-Christian origin, is that the mythological gods set humans up to have dominion over all of nature. So all the animals are just kind of here to do whatever we please with them. And we have set ourselves on this pedestal that is so much higher above the rest of the animal kingdom that it's night and day. I mean, there's no similarity, virtually no similarity between us. And what has happened, and obviously this has been something that's been going on for, you know, a few hundred years now, essentially since the advent of real hard sciences, and since people have been studying animal behavior, is that that gap of man on his lofty pedestal, second only to the gods, and the animals far below, this gap has become narrower and narrower. It used to be believed that animals could not use tools, for example. As, you know, a lot of people who have been, like Jane Goodall, who does excellent work among chimpanzees in Africa, and is still at it, I hear. Jane Goodall, you know, was one of the first people to actually observe deliberate tool use in great apes, and specifically in chimpanzees and bonobos. And this has widely become publicized and has widely become studied now. And as with a lot of things in science, eventually people just started kind of taking it for granted that we've always kind of known this. But this was huge when it came out. It was a rule changer in the way we look at primate behavior in species that are, quote unquote, lower than people. And we do now understand that this is, you know, obviously has always existed. It's a common behavior. And this has changed the way we view these primates. And we now understand that there is some capacity, maybe not for abstract thinking in the way that we think, but certainly the intelligence level of certain animals is much greater than our ancestors would have thought. Because, you know, of course, they thought dolphins were fish, too. Because it was just a simple lack of knowledge of animals and the way that their social groupings work. Now, what is really kind of happening here isn't so much that people have become lesser than they were, or that animals have become greater than they were. What's happening is that we have a greater understanding. And when you have a greater understanding, the myths and illusions of the past, including things like this exalted position of man in the scheme of things, tends to get undermined by the truth, by new knowledge is coming in. So now you can look at ourselves as part of this continuity of the animal kingdom. We're certainly in a lot of ways a lot more sophisticated than animals, obviously, because after all, we build computers and we listen to podcasts, and animals, if they listen to podcasts, probably don't get a whole lot out of them. I kind of actually getting off on a tangent here. I wonder if anybody has ever tried to teach a parrot to talk by playing it podcast. I would love to hear a parrot that was taught to talk by listening to United Kingdom talk. Can you imagine a parrot going, "I love it"? That'd be funny. A Chris Reardon parrot. That would be something. But all kidding aside, you know, we now are very much more cognizant of ourselves on this continuity, and there's an increased awareness of our place in the animal kingdom as part of the kingdom and not as something that's set far, far apart from the other creatures that we share the earth with. Now, of course, we owe that understanding to various pioneers, and especially to people like Charles Darwin, because as much as the religious people really hate the fact that we've been learning all these things that seem to indicate that we are part of the animal kingdom as opposed to apart from the animal kingdom, these facts are being borne out every single day, and more is being discovered every single day. And for those who have a sort of medieval view of things, this example of man on his high pedestal, far apart from the rest of nature, that could be a very confusing and threatening idea. And, you know, now that we don't have this sort of, you know, theocentric view of the universe with a sort of mythological God at the center and everything below it, but right below God is people. And we start looking at ourselves as to what role we play in the entire scheme of nature in general. And obviously we have progressed in a lot of ways far past any of the animals do. Now, one of the things I would argue, and so what makes animals fundamentally different from humans is not the use of tools, because obviously over the centuries we found that they do in fact use tools. Perhaps abstract thinking, that might be one pretty good indicator. But babies don't think abstractly, do they? And then you have this whole idea of a society. Now, as I talked about a few episodes ago, and I talked about this on the program, morality, all morality, doesn't matter who you are, where you are, all morality derives from the culture in which you are raised. And animals, as we understand it, don't form cultures. Their thing is all about the small group, cooperating with each other for the long-term survival of the group. And this makes perfect sense in the evolutionary scheme of things. Whereas it's hard to imagine a flock of geese, say, you know, creating a nation and having this sort of idea of a nation state. That sort of thing just doesn't seem to happen among animals. The grand ducky of quack. But you do see, of course, the small group dynamic at work, whether it be a pack of wolves or a herd of wildebeest or whatever. But this wouldn't be so different from what primitive humans probably have, or in particular chimpanzees and gorillas would have as far as their simple social structure. And of course it's all about the small group and not about this sort of abstract idea like a country. And this is how, you know, we have gone beyond that idea and have gone off into more involved forms of identifying ourselves as opposed to something that an animal might do. And at this point, this is where the idea of morality really comes into play. So you can argue certainly that animals don't have a morality in the same sense that we do. And really, the question isn't, you know, do animals have morals? I suppose that you could put it another way. Do humans have morals? Is what we call morality actually just an extension of the simple sort of social pecking order that certain species of apes have? I would argue that you could make that distinction, that everything we do is an elaboration on this very simple idea of you have certain creatures that are more powerful than others, and they sort of have this pecking order within the group that determines how successful these specific individuals are within the group. And I would really love to hear somebody like Jane Goodall talking about that topic. You could certainly make that argument. Because really all morals are, period, is the rules of society that are set down as sort of by acclamation by the group in general. And morality changes over time. It doesn't remain stable. So certainly, you know, if you look at today's culture as compared to the culture of the Victorians, you're going to find a great deal of difference. It doesn't mean that we've changed as humans, because we certainly haven't. What changes is the etiquette and the protocol behind the ways in which we express ourselves within the culture we live in. But that society has changed as the result of social pressure and things. Now, I've never seen any kind of evidence that animal groupings can change as the result of social pressure. Because frankly, the small group thing is more about survival than it is about manners or observing taboos. So I do think that certainly our society is far more involved than theirs. But you want to talk about morality. And one of the examples that was given, this was given on a show of Blast the Right, and Scott picked up on this as being significant. I haven't been able to find the study either, Scott, but the study that he was citing was apparently a study of rats, and they found that a rat who was given control over a switch, and the switch was one that was like a lever or something that would provide him with food. And the rat learned very quickly that if you hit the lever, food comes out. And then they decided to add a wrinkle to that experiment by setting up the switch so that whenever the switch was hit, an electrical charge would go through the cage of a neighboring rat. And that the rat stopped eating rather than hurt the other rat, because it would hear the cries of alarm from this other rat whenever it hit the switch, and the rat actually stopped eating as a result of doing that. It would not engage in this behavior that was hurting the other rat. And, of course, on Blast the Right, they had a political agenda to promote in telling this story. To me, the question isn't, you know, why don't people have the same kind of morality as rats do, which I think was kind of the message that this particular podcast host was trying to get across. To me, the real story is that, you know, obviously there's a capability of altruism in animals, and this narrows that gap between human and animal even more. So in a way, I feel that the guy from Blast the Right actually kind of missed the point of the study, and it wasn't really paying attention to what the study actually implies, and really shows that animals are capable of this sort of rudimentary morality, which is based, and I would say primarily, on want to allow the small group to survive. And therefore, this makes perfect sense from an evolutionary standpoint. And that's kind of what I think about that. I don't know that it's particularly significant, but it certainly does add to this conversation. Because if animals have the sort of hardwired moral code, not really a moral code, but this hardwired instinct of protection of fellows within its group, then that can tell you a lot about the hardwiring that humans have. And it's not so much that we're so much better than they are because we supposedly have morality. It actually kind of brings it home that all of us share certain characteristics. So I think that's a really, really interesting topic there. If anybody else would like to chime in on this or any other topic that's been brought up on the show, or indeed the live show, which I also post on my RSS stream, please feel free to contact me. And you can do that by contacting me through the email address, which is tom@tomharrisusa.com. And you can also contact me through Facebook on the Tom Harris USA podcast community. I have one last little piece of email here. This is from our good friend Robert Lewis Pels in Iceland, and Robert had this to say. Oh, before I read the email, actually, Robert seemed a little bit surprised that I wished everybody on Facebook a very happy solstice. And, you know, I don't think that's any indication that I'm moving to the spooky side of life. Because after all, when you think about it, the solstices and the equinoxes are the ultimate realists' holidays, because they actually denote something real that's observable in nature. So I would say that observing the solstices and the equinoxes, even though there's some pagan baggage there, I would say that it's definitely the most scientific of holidays, perhaps, to celebrate. So happy summer solstice, everybody. Anyway, back to the email. Dear Tom, I present to you evidence as to the existence of my elven friends. I found this row of houses on a trip to Mývatn, an area reasonably close to my house in northern Iceland. Obviously, these are new dwellings and point most graphically to the existence of a vibrant community. These dwellings are very close to a hotel. This area is very geologically active and home to a natural spa. I love to visit the spa and soak in warm water while looking out upon a snowy landscape. Magical, even during a summer, snow can be seen on tops of the mountains way off in the distance. A short drive away and one can see steam pouring from the ground alongside bubbling pools of mud that give testament to an active earth. That sounds absolutely wonderful, Robert. And he sends along a photo. It looks like a little house, maybe a row of three doors. One thing I noticed about this, Robert, and I think this might be an elf trap. And the reason why is because this entire thing in the interior is lined with steel. And isn't steel an alloy of iron? And iron's supposed to be poisonous to elves, isn't it? So I don't know. This kind of looks like it's a bit dodgy to me. You might want to ask them about that, especially if any elves may be at risk. So thanks for that, Robert. And of course, you know, if I ever come to Iceland, I'm definitely going to have you take me there, because that sounds absolutely wonderful. Soaking and looking at the mountains and the snow. That sounds like a real good vacation to me. Anyhow, it's time to go. Got to take off now. Don't forget that I do a live show on UnitedKingdomRadio.co.uk, and that is on Saturday morning at 10 a.m. Central Time, which is 4 p.m. over in the UK. You can Skype in at United Kingdom Radio. Thanks for listening. This is Tom in Chicago, Illinois, signing off. We'll see you next time.